Hello and welcome to the StoryGrid podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better writer. I'm your host, Tim Grawl, and I am a struggling writer trying to figure out how to tell a story that works. Joining me shortly is Sean Coyne. He is a creator of StoryGrid, the author of the book StoryGrid, and an editor with over 25 years experience. This whole episode is a shameless plug for my new book, Running Down a Dream. If you've been listening for a while, you know I've been working on this book for over 2 years, and it's finally coming out next week, and I'm really excited to share it with you. And so Sean and I spend the episode talking about the origins of the book, what it was like to write this book and work on this book together. And the goal here is to get you to buy a copy. Now that it's coming out, I'd really appreciate it if you went and picked up a copy of Running Down a Dream for yourself or for a friend or for, you know, every single person you've ever met. Anyway, you can see more at runningdownadream.com, and there's a couple different options there. You can go ahead and pre-order the book on Amazon. The print book won't be available until July 11th, but you can go ahead and pre-order the Kindle copy, or you can go to blackirishbooks.com, and there is a bundle available where you can get the ebook and the audiobook for both my book, Running Down a Dream, and Steve Pressfield's new book, The Artist's Journey, for a really low price. We wanted to come out with these books at the same time and make an offer where you could get basically the digital bundle of both books at a really good price. So you can go to runningdownadream.com and check that out. But this episode, I hope you enjoy it. It was good for us to kind of look back at what it's been like to work on this book. And this is the first book that's being published out of this podcast. So it's really special to us, but I think it'll be a helpful episode. So let's jump in and get started.
So Tim, I'm going to sort of be asking some questions here today, because one of the things that I face as an editor is the absolute and complete resistance of writers to take editorial feedback. And the reason why I bring this up is that, and we'll get into the reasons why I want to know why you wanted to write Running Down a Dream to begin with, but the pivotal moment, the turning point of our work together on this nonfiction book was we set out to do a big idea book. And I think you immediately thought, oh, well, I can do this. I know what my big idea is. My big idea is how to practically win the war of art. I mean, that's the way you pitched the book to me from the very beginning, was I want to write a book about how to, you know, win the war of art in very practical terms. But the turning point on this project was when the big idea book turned into a memoir of sorts, in that one of the things we talk about in StoryGrid all the time is point of view and narrative device. And what we discovered in the process of putting together your big idea book was that the thing that would make the big idea actually work and be interesting beyond a self-helpy tool book was using the narrative device of memoir to explain how these tools came to you and how you use them. So my question to you is, how did you make that leap? How did you turn from giving up the notion of being sort of the pedantic smart guy who's giving tools to the extremely vulnerable kind of guy who's stumbling around in the actual final book? Because you do not come off as, you know, a Harvard professor in this book in any way, shape, or form. So how did you make that mind shift, and have you made that mind shift? And did you consciously understand that's what you were doing?
Yeah, when you say that, I think of in the blurb Ryan Holiday wrote, he said, Tim isn't some once in a million genius, which I think is my favorite part of all the blurbs. Yeah, you know, I've actually thought a lot about this, because we're sitting a little over 2 years since I started. I was probably about halfway through the first draft of the book 2 years from right now. 2 years ago. And yeah, I set out to just do the same thing I had done in my other books, was to just write this very kind of, I know the secrets and I'm going to share the secrets to you kind of how-to book. Because it worked in my first two books. And it was interesting because, well, I think the biggest thing was you and I had started working together on the podcast. So, and one of my rules, which I actually talk about how I came to this rule in the book, is when I'm working with somebody who's a professional, I have to decide if I trust them. Do I trust them or not? And if I trust them, then I stop worrying about what I want and just do whatever I'm told and just trust that they know what they're doing. And I feel like it works really well when, even if you get bad advice, because there's been times where like you've told me to do something and I go and do it and I come back and you're like, I shouldn't have told you to do that. You know, like we went the wrong direction. And so I was really committed, especially once, you know, it didn't happen at first, but you know, we talked about the book off and on for a long time. And then it became something where I knew that you might be interested in publishing it for Black Irish. And that alone gave me this pause of like, okay, I can't really like dick around with this book. It has to be a certain level of quality. And once again, you're not now just the teaching me how to write. You're also like the gatekeeper for Black Irish of like, I'm not going to publish something that's not, you know, up to our standards. So anyway, that's to say, I felt like with this book, I was put in this interesting position where I didn't have any pressure to finish the book at first. So I just kind of worked on it as I could. But at the same time, I had extreme pressure to make it better, right? So I didn't have to like churn out a book to hit some arbitrary date that was set by the publisher. But at the same time, there was a lot of pressure to make the book better. And so I felt like, you know, I kept kind of churning on it and I would send you something and you're like, okay, it's not quite there yet. And, you know, we would come to that conclusion through various means. And I felt like when we had the turning point, when I finally understood, you know, putting my story in and all that kind of thing, you know, for me, it was just this like, it was what you talk about of like the muse showing up. You know, it was like it finally clicked of what I had to do. And I knew I had to do it because I desperately didn't want to. It was the thing I had been avoiding. You know, it's like, you know, other areas of your life where you're like actively avoiding this thing you know you need to do. And at some point you come to a decision like, well, it's a little like story, right? It's the progressive complications. And then you finally reach the point where you can no longer put off this decision. So I think for me, it was putting myself in a position where I trust you and I was just going to keep working on it until you said it was good enough and let you kind of pressure me to make it better. Because I never like when people tell me what I'm doing is not good enough. And the vast majority of my work, I don't have somebody doing that, right? Like I am the only, you know, once I decide it's good enough, then it's good enough and I put it out in the world or whatever. But this just felt like over and over just running into a wall, but assuming you knew what you were doing. You know, even though you couldn't articulate with words what you were looking for, you would know it when you saw it and just trusting that process. And so, and then also once I rewrote the introduction that basically became the final introduction of the book, I immediately knew this was right. And I sent it to a couple of friends of mine and they were both like, this is the best writing you've ever done. And so that's where then I feel like, well, it was worth it. You know, like, because there were so many times that I was like, dude, I want this out by this date. And I think the first one was like a year and a half ago, you know, and it's like I finally was just like, I'm not, you know, it's the same thing with the novel, with the threshing. It's like my take. I forgot when I came to this, but I started saying it. I would say it's ready when Sean says it's ready. Because I don't know enough to know when the book's ready or not. So I'm just basically trusting that Sean will tell me when it's ready.
So, yeah, I just want to comment about the notion of me being the arbiter of whether or not the story works. And yes, that is correct. But I think we get confused often with the sort of the, how would you say it, the slave to the methodology versus the methodology. My point is that while I am evaluating the story and I will have the decision about whether or not the thing is publishable or not, or up to quote unquote my standards, the thing that I'm using to do that is what we've been, you know, talking about for 2+ years on the Story Grid. And my ultimate goal is to not have people say, well, Sean says it's good enough, so it's good enough. What I want them to actually say to themselves is, look, I put it through the Story Grid. I've analyzed it on 7 different levels. And through my analysis, through that, I can honestly say that this is at a level that is suitable to me. And so part of the difficulty of being in my chair is that I don't have all the answers, right? And this is what I really loved about the evolution of your book, is that we moved away from the, you know, the ivory tower know-it-all genius giving the bottom line of how to get something at the minimum viable amount of pain, right?
Right.
Because that's sort of what a lot, most self-help is. The writer, the expert, does not share the very difficult, painful process by which they came to that information. And I think that's a disservice to people. And it's not easy to do that in a way that makes the reader interested in the story while also learning the secrets that that person has painfully learned. You spoke earlier of, I knew this was right because I knew this is something I didn't want to do, so I knew I had to do it. And that feeling that you talk about is actually been described by Carl Jung when he said, the thing that we are required to do, the information that will set us free, the things that will provide meaning in our lives are kept in places that we really don't want to go. We have to go to places that are painful. We have to experience some level of suffering in order for us to actually be able to store the memory, so to speak, in a way that is actually useful. So I'm not saying that every moment of writing should be this excruciating, torturous thing. And in fact, what you also said is that's true too. It's like once you cross the threshold of pain, then the muse is like feeding you so many great things that it's actually freeing. You're like, oh, this, all this stuff about the IRS guy coming to my door and demanding payment, you know what? That used to haunt me. Now it's kind of funny. And now I can actually, you know, it still hurts, but I can share that story. And then what other people learn from the memoirish part of your thing, and I think a lot of people are actually going to read your book as memoir, not as what we initially intended it to be. And right. I think that's great because if you can write a memoir that is so on the money in a way that is emotionally transforming to the reader, all the lessons inside the memoir become deeply embedded in that person anyway. So I'm sure you've felt this experience where, and I'm sure a lot of people who bought the Story Grid feel this way, they keep saying to themselves, oh, the answers to that problem that I'm having are in the Story Grid. So I've got that on my desk. And when I hit that problem, I'll just dig up that answer from the Story Grid. Instead of it being embedded inside their sort of psyche and having the answer come to them intuitively. And I think the process by which you can convey the information in a way that is immediately available to the person who reads the story is through personal story, like, you know, inciting incident, progressive complication, turning point, crisis, climax, and resolution. Those, you know, 5 things are really crucial to actually lodge inside of our brains because we're narratively driven.
Well, one of my, when you were talking about
putting it in that order of the five commandments, one of my favorite moments in dealing with this book was in the fall. You and I both were struggling with what to do with this. We knew it wasn't working. There wasn't the arc wasn't there. We weren't really figuring out. We couldn't figure out how to go from the start to the finish of the book. And we were with Steve Pressfield. And we kind of, in like 5 minutes, you know, just kind of like, here's what the book's about, da, 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 da. And I like told him what was in the introduction. And he like was like, oh, that's your ending. Just move it from the introduction to the end of the book. And we were like, oh my God, he's right. And like that ended up being like the end of the, you know, the arc of the book. And it was just so interesting because I am rarely in the hanging out with writers that have as prolific as Steve. And it was just like this obvious thing to him. He's like, yeah, well, that's your end. Like, what's wrong with you guys? Like,
that's funny that you bring that up because I just want to put on my sort of publisher hat right now. And one of the problems a publisher faces is how do we, and I said this before, so I'm going to use a swear word for all those people who are very sensitive. But as a publisher, you're always thinking, how am I going to sell this piece of shit? You know? And and Steve and I say that all the time, and especially with the stuff that Steve writes. So, and the Story Grid, we know when I wrote that, Steve said, well, how are we going to sell this piece of shit? So as a publisher, I was thinking, well, geez, you know, Steve is writing this very, because Steve's book, The Artist's Journey, is a very, very intense, big picture, 30,000 foot view of what it means to be an artist, right? Globally. What is art about? How does one become a creative force? And how does one evaluate their progression through life? I love the book because it's all about seeing, you know, the big picture, the big abstraction about art. So it's sort of, if you were to put it in terms of, you know, neuroscience, it's the right side of the brain point of view. And so when you were telling me about your book, and this all came to me in like January, and when we finally sort of figured out that yours was the very practical micro detail stuff of actually, you know, moving from a desire to do one specific thing to getting that thing across the finish line, then I'm like, oh, that's in terms of neuroscience, that's the left side of the brain. And so as a publisher, I'm like, we should publish both of these books at the exact same time and let it be known, not to like sledgehammer it, but let it be known that if you want to sort of look at the artist's life, Steve's book, The Artist's Journey, is going to give you the right side of the brain perspective, and Tim's book, Running Down a Dream, is going to give you the left side of the brain. So extremely practical and extremely fantastical and abstract. And when you put those two things together, you get the global picture of what it means to be a creative force. And the best creative forces understand both of those things. So it's funny to me that when you were telling the story about how when we met with Steve, you and I are these left-brained thinkers and we're trying to, you know, slice this thing a million different ways. And then we come to the guru on the mountain, Steve. He's like, oh, you idiots. It's easy. You got your beginning. You got your ending at the beginning and you got to put in a new beginning for your ending. And then once he said that, we both kind of looked at each other and like, oh, okay, so that's done. Let's go to our next problem. And that was really cool to see is that Steve is a master of the big idea, the big abstraction, but he's also the master of the micro problem too. So we gave him a very specific micro problem. And like a great editor, and he edited the Story Grid, and he did an amazing job. Like a great editor, he said, oh, well, simply your problem is this. Just fix that. And probably the rest of the story will unwind. And then we did that. We took his advice. We just listened to him. And it didn't happen immediately, but probably around mid-January, maybe February, you nailed it. And then I threw the deadline at you, right?
Yeah. That was what was interesting. Because, well, I feel like what happened is like he gave us like the bookends. Like I'm starting here and I'm going there. And then I just had, like, I couldn't figure out how to get there. And because I had rewritten it again, and it was still just not working. And you kept telling me to, you know, write it as a story. And I thought I was, and I wasn't, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it was like that gave us like this, then we had just figured out how to fill in the middle part basically. And it was just interesting. And then, you know, it's funny to hear you talk about it as a memoir, because I have felt like that, but it's like, I don't think we're going to market it as a memoir, and I don't want to be a memoirist. Like that's not what I set out to do here, you know? So it's just so funny to me the way these things flow. I feel like one of the things I'm taking away from this that, you know, I've learned in other areas, but has really been driven in here, is to just wait. Trust the process. So I'm 37. So it seems like the less time you have to live, the more you realize you're not in a hurry. Like, you know, like I feel like 10 years ago in my 20s, I felt like everything was a hurry. I need to get it all done now. If I didn't get it done now, it would never get done. And like, this is the first project where I just felt like, you know, however long it takes, and it'll be fine. And so it was really good to feel like, because I felt like many times, you know, this shouldn't be taking this long. What's wrong with me? We should have this book done now. And this is how every project starts for me, is like, this won't take very long, you know? And so, you know, it's just been interesting to like look back over the process of the last 2 years, because there were many times where I could have wrapped it up, sent it to a copy editor, and self-published, and it would have been done. And over and over, when I kind of came to that, I'm like, I don't know, like, I don't think I want to do that with this book yet. And I'll just wait a little bit longer. And it's always hard to know when you're waiting because of resistance, because then you have people like Seth saying, just, you know, ship, you know? And so am I waiting because of resistance, or am I waiting because it's actually not done yet?
Well, I think your point about getting a little bit older, it's a life progression, right? So, you know, I'm 53, so I'm at a different level, lifespan than you are. And I've reached the point in my life where there's only so many projects that I have left, right? I'm not being morbid, I'm just being realistic. And so everything that I do from this point forward, I seriously consider, is this something that is going to expand my knowledge, and will I can't settle anymore. I'm not going to settle for it's fine. And, you know, Seth Godin's point about shipping is extraordinarily important, because the majority of people's problems when they're younger, or even people who don't really reach a maturation point until later in their life, is that they're just so damn afraid of putting the thing and saying, done. You know what? This is done. It's out. I'm shipping it. It's over. And that's really a skill that you have to learn. Now, I've got a good 300-400 books in my past that are done, right? So I know I can finish a project. I'm no longer fearing that. So it's like the IRS agent, you know, I can laugh about it. Oh, yeah, remember I stayed up all night to finish that book so I can meet my deadline. Yeah, blah. But now what I want is, I don't want to work on things that weren't taken up a level. And I talk about leveling up all the time, but it's not just the writers that I work with, it's myself as an editor. And I could have, as an editor, said to you, you know what, Tim, you know, this is probably a level above your previous books now. Shit, let's throw some covers on it and throw it out there. And I could have done that, right? But I didn't. I didn't do that, because first of all, I've made a commitment to myself, and that's really nice. But the other commitment I have is to Steve Pressfield, right? Steve is my business partner in Black Irish, and I didn't want to send Steve something that he says, "Oh, okay, yeah, sure, we can publish this, but wow, I thought we were, you know, doing something a little bit higher level than this, but hey, if you want to publish it, that's okay, Sean, if you think it'll make some money. But geez, you know, this really isn't. He represents, we all need, and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, the metaphorical heroes on our wall. When we're little boys and we're little girls, we put things on our walls, and they're usually people we admire. You know, maybe it's Leonard Bernstein, or maybe it's Sylvia Plath, or maybe it's Jane Austen. There are photographs of our idols, and we say to ourselves, and we look at them, we actually look up to them and say, someday, maybe, if I work really hard, I might be able to produce something that's a little bit worse than what they've done. And, right? And yeah, yeah. So we're looking to level up our stuff. And then we learn our craft based upon the idyllic IDOL of our childhood. So when we get older, what often happens is that we start, all of our idols, our IDOLs, they start to take on a tarnish. We discover something, oh, that guy's kind of a jerk. I can't believe I idolized him. You know, maybe there isn't anything worth meaning anymore. Maybe there's nothing to sort of try and get better at. And when you're very, very fortunate, you work with people over long periods of time who don't let you down. And Steve is a guy that I've worked with for 25 years. And he's never let me down, and I try never to let him down either. And so the two of us sort of look to each other as, you know what, is this Steve worthy? And he probably says to himself, is Sean going to give me shit if I give him this draft? Is he, you know, how much crap is he going to give me? Is he going to say, you know, is he going to be nice to me and say, well, we're going to, you know, roll up our sleeves here, Steve, and do a little work? Or is he going to go, wow, let's do a couple more drafts, but you're almost there? So together, that's what we provide. So when I was working with you, I couldn't settle for me, and I couldn't settle for Steve. So for you now, you sort of have me in the middle and then Steve even higher. So for you, when you started with me on the Story Grid podcast, I don't think it's a coincidence that one of the first projects you wanted to talk about beyond your novel, and I think it's funny we started the podcast so that you would write a novel, and the first book we publish is your nonfiction. I don't think it's a coincidence that you said to me, you know what, I'd like to do something like Steve, right? Yeah. I want to write a book like Steve did. And so when you said that, I go, oh, do you now? You know, it only took Steve 30 years to write The War of Art, and you want to just bang something out? Well, let's see about that. So I didn't say that to you at the time because, you know, you don't say to somebody who wants to be a great figure skater, oh, you're never going to be, you know, Tara Lipinski or whoever, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You go, okay, well, let's put on your ice skates. Let's see how those work. You know, can you get the laces the right way? Do you have any, you know, blisters because you put on your skates the wrong way? So at that point, and then, of course, Steve drops The Artist's Journey on me in the middle of this, and I'm like, wow, this is brilliant. This takes, you know, The War of Art to another level. I certainly cannot let Tim get away with a, you know, a how-to guide to overcoming your problems. He's going to have to really step up. And, you know, we talk about the muse and about, you know, all the stuff that we don't understand about the universe, but I don't think it's a coincidence that the book wasn't cracked until the three of us came together. Steve heard us out, because I hadn't really talked to Steve about your book before, because honestly, I didn't want to promise him something or talk about something that I didn't think was ready yet.
Right.
So it was time to talk to Steve about your book. And when we did, then bang, he drops, you know, this perfect gift in front of us that solved a problem. It took 6 months from the time Steve told us that thing until final draft. Only 6 months.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas it took, you know, 20 months before that to get to that point. But if you hadn't really, you know, thrashed around for 20 months and given yourself the permission to try three or four different tries, then what Steve had said, we would have been like, nah, that won't work. You know, Steve, we really thought this through. You know, I can't tell you how many times people have said that to me. Oh, your story grid stuff's interesting and all, but it just won't work for me. Okay, well, fine. Then go off for another 7 years and then come back and say, well, maybe you had some good ideas there. But anyway, the whole concept, just to circle back to what you have to do as a publisher, is you have to think about, well, what level of book do I want to publish? Am I here years ago when I had an independent publishing company in the paradigm of New York publishing, there was something that I called feeding the monster. And the monster was the distribution chain. And if I didn't feed it product, if I didn't get books delivered in stores at a specific time, I could lose my distribution network. And back then, distribution was everything. If I didn't have Random House distributing me, I wouldn't have gotten into Barnes & Noble or Borders or any of the 99% of stores that sold books. Now, that monster isn't there anymore. So when you have the opportunity not to have to feed a monster in order to make payroll, then don't feed the monster. Feed the craft. Work on the craft. Because what will happen is you will never regret ever, ever doing an extra draft. I have a lot of editorial regrets in my day, but not one is because I did an extra draft or I asked for an extra thing or I went one final analytical ladder, you know, too many. No, 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 no. That's never happened to me. In fact, the only regret is, you know, I guess it's sort of the exact same thing for the writer. If I had unlimited time and unlimited amount of analytical tools, I wonder what I could help create. And that's why we need people like Seth Godin to say, you know what, you got to ship it too. Don't forget about shipping it, because it doesn't matter if you don't ship it. And yeah, we could do another two or three drafts on your book and make it better. But why? It's ready now. Now is the time. So as a publisher, I don't feed the monster anymore. I'm just about, is this Steve worthy? And is this something that if I sell 30 copies of it, I won't care? And yeah, you've reached that very low bar.
No, it was funny. Right before we got on, you said that. You're like, hey, you know, even if we just sell 30 copies, it's fine when it comes out. And then I looked and we've already had 17 pre-orders. So I'm already halfway to what I need to make you happy, which is what's been good. You know, I've worked with, I don't know, probably imprints of all the major five publishers, you know, working with authors and launching their book and helping them get it out in the world, you know, and then I self-publish my other books. And so I've had several people ask me about, that's probably good for me to talk about for a minute. You know, I've asked why traditionally publish. Why did I make that decision? Which this is like, I don't know. I don't like the word hybrid publishing. I feel like that's this weird thing everybody's trying to do. But this isn't like I'm getting published by Penguin. And, you know, but why would I decide to go from self-published to traditionally published? And I feel like the way I make these decisions and the way that I encourage every writer to make the decision is they should start with self-publishing first. Like that should be their default. I feel like, you know, if I have a car that is worth something, you know, I have a 2016 Prius and it has some value to it. And if I wanted to sell it, I wouldn't go around asking people to give me anything for it. Like I would know, like, this is what it's worth. And when somebody's willing to pay me that, then they get the car. And I feel like that with books is like I've created something of value. Maybe mine's a Prius and yours is a Tesla, but like it still has value. And people should offer something. If they're going to get the rights to that thing I've created, they should offer me something of equal value. And so I just didn't feel like when I looked at traditional publishing that I would get something of equal value, especially with the chains that would be put around my wrist on how I could promote the book. And so, you know, working with you guys has just been, you know, I feel like, okay, you're getting this thing I created, which has value. And then what I'm getting in return is one, I'm getting you as my editor, right? Like I can't afford to pay you what it costs otherwise. So I get you as an editor. I get access to Steve's name, like at least one of the people that blurred me, probably two or three. They blurred me because I'm associated with Steve. You know, because I'm being published by him, my book looks like his books, it's being published alongside his book. So that alone is opening doors for me that weren't open before. Also, the revenue split is much nicer than most publishers. And then for me, the other thing is like, you still see this as my book. And so I'm like, hey, I want to give away 100 copies at this speaking event. You're like, go ahead. I'm like, hey, I want to send no DRM. I just want to send the ebook to some people to get them to review it on Amazon. And you're like, go for it. You know, like there's just, you're just letting me, you're trusting me to take care of this valuable thing I created, which is not what I've seen with other publishers. And so for me, I feel like, you know, I get the best of both worlds. Like I get so many of the good things that go with self-publishing. Most of it's, you know, the freedom to do what I want to do. And then I get all of these other things by publishing with you guys of, you know, the editorial, the design, you know, the access to Cali that helps with the promotion and getting, you know, getting things done behind the scenes. And then, you know, Steve didn't know at the time that my book was being published by Black Irish, but like I was sitting in that room because that was like our plan was for me to do stuff with Black Irish, you know? So it's like having Steve speak into the book and all of that. And so to me, it like was a no-brainer when we started discussing perhaps Black Irish, you know, publishing the book. It just seemed like such an opportunity. And then again, you know, I have projects I do for the money. And then I have projects I do because they matter to me. And this kind of goes back to when we were talking about the blurbs, and there was that one particular author that I'm like, I could get this author to give me a blurb, but I don't want that person's name on this book. Like I'll put that name on a different book, you know? And I kind of feel like that with this of like, you know, getting to put this book along when people go to blackirishbooks.com, my book will be there next to Steve's, you know, and that is extremely meaningful. So I feel like, you know, when people are thinking about what to do with their book, you know, just even if you think your book is shit, you know, you have still created something of value and you need to put that into the equation when you start thinking about what you're going to do with it. Because once, you know, like you own the rights to this book now. And so like you own the rights to this book to sell, you know, in all the territories, which means I'm not allowed to do that anymore. And so that's a big deal. And so I feel like people forget that it's not really yours anymore, you know? And so when a publisher picks it up, they now own something that you don't own anymore. And really thinking through what you're giving up and what you're getting in return, I think is really important because a lot of authors, you know, get into this situation where it's like all of a sudden they don't own their book anymore and they don't feel like they didn't get what they thought in return, but they never actually thought it through. They were just so happy that somebody was picking them that they were just like, I'll take whatever you give me. So anyway, I feel like one, you know, I'm just thrilled and over the moon and feel very privileged to get to be a part of Black Irish in this way. But then also I didn't just like, when we first started talking about it, I didn't immediately be like, oh yeah, absolutely. Like I called Josh Kaufman. I talked to a couple friends of mine to make sure this was a good decision because even at the time, the draft I was sitting on was not good. I knew I was creating something of value and I didn't want to just, you know, willy-nilly give that away.
Well, for all those aspiring publishers out there, I think the point to really take away is whether or not you like Steve's books or you appreciate my methods or whatever, at least we have something to actually provide meaning to somebody. And I think the problem that publishers have is that they lack meaningful representation of what they're about. So if you want to become a publishing company or a brand of anything, you really need to think about what you stand for and what the meaning of your company is really about. So when you were talking about, you know, the decision to go with Black Irish or not, to me, the best place to be as a publisher is to say to yourself, it's not the end of the world if Tim decides not to come with us, because you did provide value. You've had two very successful books before. You have a great following. You could have sold your project, this book, to, and they would have been happy to buy a self-help book by Tim Grawl to teach you how to overcome, you know, resistance. And I'm sure through your friends in publishing, they were all like, yeah, send me a proposal, I'll buy that. But the point that you were making is that when you sign over a deal, and you did this with me, you're signing over 70 years of copyright plus your life. So if you live to be 80, then I get the copyright all the way until you die, and then I get another 70 years. So it's no small thing to say to yourself, wow, I'm giving up about 100 years of revenue from my book for how much? What am I getting? Am I getting $10,000? Well, gee, that's not that much money. And I can't give it to my friends if I want to? Oh, that's kind of bad. So there's no big wall up about our revenue split. It's a 50-50 deal. And Steve and I always said, publishing should be a partnership between the publisher and the writer. So what we do is very simple calculation, is all of the money that comes in, we subtract some overhead costs that we, you know, agree to with you, and then we split everything 50-50. And it's a very simple formula that really maintains the partnership. It's a handshake. If you work with us, we will give you access to our community of people who like us, and you get to promote the book to your community of people. And then when all the money comes in, we'll subtract some overhead, and then we'll split it 50-50, and we'll show you what we subtracted. And if you have a problem with it, we'll talk about it.
You know, that's one thing I didn't mention that I should have, is that also, like, most publishing deals don't come with a built-in audience. And Black Irish has their own audience, and then Steve's audience as well, which is, like, you know, in our opinion, the way it should be. But that's the other thing I didn't even mention that I did take into account, is it's like, it's not just the fact that I can be like, hey, you know, Steve's publishing me, you should talk to me, to like influencers. It's also Steve has a large group of people he influences, and he's going to say, go buy this book, you know? And right there, like, any of the costs you're taking out is more than paid for by getting 50% of the revenue off of his audience, you know? And so...
Well, that's the future of publishing, Tim. I mean, it's not a big secret that if a publisher can establish their own relationships with people who care about what they do, then all the better, because then what it does is it makes the publisher level up their work so that they just don't publish any random thing that will disappoint their audience. They have to think about, will Alice in Topeka, Kansas really be angry with me if I, you know, if I push her to buy this book? She buys the book and goes, oh my God, this is terrible. I'm never going to buy anything from those people again. So it requires the publisher to maintain the truth of their mission, or they no longer be a publisher. So
No, it's good. It's just, that's my feeling on this, is like, I just talked to so many writers that are like desperate for anybody, you know, and it's both sides of like, one, if you can't get anybody interested, you should go work on your craft and get better. But then when people are interested, that doesn't automatically mean it's worth it. And a long time ago in business, I started telling people like, look, I'm going to expect you to look out for yourself, and I'm going to look out for myself. And when you and I started talking about like working together on StoryGrid, and we, you know, had to do a contract and everything, I'm like, look, you ruthlessly look out for you, because I'm going to ruthlessly look out for me. You know, so I said, that doesn't mean I'm trying to undercut or do anything shady, of course, but it also means like, look, I want this to work for me just as much as I want it to work for you, because if it's one-sided, the thing will unravel. Like, even if it's one-sided in your favor, it'll unravel for you. And I just, you know, there's lots of people that get, I don't know lots, but there are people that get traditional publishing deals that it is 100% worth it, right? like a Malcolm Gladwell. You know what I mean? Like, he can't pull off what his publisher can pull off for him. But like, the first time novelist that's getting a $5,000 advance that will get a good cover, decent editing, and then they're on their own, you got to just think about that. The fact that you're giving up probably 75% of the revenue. And so I'm just, you know, one of the things we wanted to do in this episode, we want to talk about running down a dream, but we also just wanted to talk about some of the processes behind getting this book out in the world. And for me personally, that was a big one because this is my first traditionally published book, right? This is the first cover that I didn't design. You know, this is the first editor that I didn't hire. You know, this is like a big deal for me, but I didn't just like immediately, whatever. Yeah, I got a yes. I'm not going to mess with the yes by asking questions, you know? And I think that's just as important as developing a work of art that you're proud of that we've been talking about. I think the other side is, you know, one of the things I had somebody a couple years ago ask me, if I look back at all the book launches, like, what was like the one thing that like made the biggest difference for book launches? And it was funny because most questions I get asked, I have an immediate answer because I've been asked so many times when it comes to book marketing. But this was the first one that just stumped me. And I was just like, you know, I've never thought of that. So I start thinking through and I start thinking about the email list or the blog or, and I couldn't find anything that everybody had that I had worked with that had had a successful launch. And then I landed on it and I was like, oh, I know what it is. The author actually has to believe that it's a good thing for somebody to buy a copy of their book. And yeah, you laugh because it seems crazy, but so many authors, like if you back them into a corner and say, should somebody buy a copy of your book? Is it worth their money? They will not say yes. They will hesitate and they'll kind of cajole and they feel bad and da 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 da. And I'm like, and the authors that I've seen that are successful, like when they are done with their book, they're like, the best $10 or $15 or $20 that you can spend right now is to buy a copy of my book. It will give you over 10x value and it's so worth it. Whether it's fiction or nonfiction, it doesn't matter. So, you know, I've had to do that as I get ready to promote Running Down a Dream, because this is such a different book than I promoted before. But I think the same idea goes into selling the book too, is you have to understand you have something of value. And if you don't think you have something of value, why are you trying to get an agent or a publisher to pick it up anyway? And then if you do have something of value, then you should get something in return for that value. So I don't know, I've harped on it probably enough. But that is just an important thing for me as somebody that works with so many creative people that undervalue what they're bringing to the table. And it just always makes me sad.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so the question would probably arise, how do you get to the place where you value your work, right? And the way you get to the place where you value your work is by leveling up your craft and not settling for something that's okay. And when you understand that there are only so many projects in your life that you can take on, then you get to a place where you really don't want to create something that isn't your best work. And I don't mean the best work when you're 83 years old. I mean the best work for right now. And you can honestly say, Tim, that you did not quit on this project. You got a very rapid deadline, probably when you least expected it, and you nailed the deadline and you did the work and you created something that is a different kind of self-help book. This is not your traditional how to overcome, you know, creative writer's block book. This is a meld between memoir, very personal storytelling with a very, very smart arc from naivete to maturation. And it's also a big idea book. And the big idea is delivered, you know, thanks Steve, as the ending payoff of the entire book. So we all have dreams. We all have things that we want. And the point of your book is really about overcoming the very, very painful obstacles that are going to be thrown up in your way, and to just keep moving forward and keep thinking about becoming a better craftsman. And once you do that, then the value of the work becomes so obvious to you that you're going to treat that thing like a baby. This is your child. And, you know, you're not going to ever question, oh, you get to spend time with my child for $10? Well, geez, that's the best deal in the world. So anyway, I mean, that's the process. For me, it was very, very enlightening to see how I don't have all the answers. You don't have all the answers, but the journey of working through the project from the editor and the writer point of view, we got a little bit closer each time, a little bit closer, a little bit closer. And then we hit a turning point when we met with Steve. He gave us the linchpin piece of information. And then 6 months later, we had a very terrific book that you're happy with, I'm happy with, and most importantly, Steve's happy with. So happy with it that he's actually okay and is very excited about sharing it with the people who love his work. So it took a long time. This did not happen in 3 months. This was like a 2-year project. And before this 2 years, you already had been working on it in your mind for probably another 2 years. Yeah. So it's a long, hard slog, but it's worth it. And now I don't think you feel in the least hesitant to say, buy my book, you're going to get something out of it. And that's the payoff. That's what it's all about.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the StoryGrid podcast. For everything StoryGrid related, check out storygrid.com. Make sure you pick up a copy of the book and sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss anything happening in the StoryGrid universe. If you'd like to check out the show notes for this episode or any past episodes, all of that can be found at storygrid.com/podcast. And once again, I'd really love it if you picked up a copy of my new book, Running Down a Dream, and you can see more about that at runningdownadream.com. If you would like to reach out to us, you can find us on Twitter at StoryGrid. Lastly, if you would like to support the show, you can do that by telling another author about the show and by visiting us on Apple Podcasts and leaving a rating and review. Thanks for subscribing and being a part of our work here at StoryGrid. We will see you next week.